Hey everybody, it's a pleasure for me to be able to introduce our communicator today because in many ways he represents what our church is all about. Marcus Johnson is the student pastor at our Effingham campus. Marcus is a gifted communicator. He's going to do a great job for us today. But you know, Marcus grew up in our church. He came to Christ here. He was discipled here. He went off to college and grew spiritually during his college days because of the foundation that was laid here. Marcus has served multiple internships at our church while he was in college. And friends, when he got out of school, we just felt like, man, here's a guy who would have a tremendous impact at our church. He served in our children's ministry. He's grown up through the whole ministry system here at Savannah Christian. He's married a wonderful girl from our church. He has a brand new baby named Andrew. He is just a great leader, great husband, great dad. And Marcus is going to bring the word of God for us today. And I just can't wait for you to hear what he's got to say. So let's give a warm Savannah Christian welcome to, you know, a son of Savannah Christian, Marcus Johnson.
Well, hey, it's great to be here with you. I want to start off by giving a shout out to the regional campuses of Savannah Christian Church, especially the Effingham campus, my family in Rincon, the Ham fam. Love you. Love being here with you too, because I did grow up at the Henderson campus, as Cam was mentioning. And so I find it an honor anytime I get to be here with the Cam fam. And y'all be free to use that if you want to. Why not, you know? Hey, listen, if you are here for the first time, or if you are here for the first time in a few weeks, let me say you have impeccable timing because we are in the middle of an awesome series. We're talking all about how God is greater than, he is bigger than, more powerful than anything that we could face in our lives, any obstacles or challenges we may have. And it's been a great series, and tonight I hope that it'll continue that way as we talk about addiction. And addiction is something that does affect all of us, whether it's something that you struggle with personally, or if it's something that someone close to you, you know, they're just tormented by some kind of habit they can't seem to break. It affects all of us. And so tonight, what we want to do is we want to leave this place tonight with a very simple yet impactful truth lodged in our minds and in our hearts, and it's this: that there is no sin or addiction that is stronger than the cross of Christ. That's where we're going tonight. But to get there, first we have to talk about something the Bible calls idolatry. Because at the root of every addiction is what the Bible calls idolatry. Idolatry is any time you worship something other than God. And in our 21st century U.S. mindset, we're thinking about idolatry as like people that chop up chickens or goats in front of little statues. And so we're thinking, how could this be relevant to me? Well, the methods have changed, but the heart issue is still there. We still put things before God all the time. I remember the precise moment that I realized I was worshiping something other than God. And I want to tell you about it. But to tell you about it, I need some help. This is what I need from you. I need two people that are in here right now wearing black that are willing to come up on stage and do anything I ask them to do. An easy sell. I know. Hands shoot up across the sanctuary. Really, it's church. It won't be that bad, I swear. Anybody going to hook me up? Oh, so the parents are pointing. We got one. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you. Who else? Who else wants to come up and help me out? You're up? Come on. All right. Come on up. Yes, just come right on stage. You don't realize this, but at the regional campuses, you're pulling a Patrick Swayze. You're ghosting right through the walls, but that's just a regional campus thing. All right, you're coming up as well. Hey, I'm Marcus.
Jimmy.
Hello. Hey, I'm Marcus.
Andy.
Awesome. Thank you all so much. All right, this is what I need you all to do. What I'm going to ask you all to do is hug. Sure, yeah, that's what I want. And then if you can sit in that chair and you can sit in that chair, I'll tell you when I need you, okay? Awesome. All right. November 10th. 2007. I was a student at the University of Georgia, and November 10th was a Saturday, which means it was a big day, because every Saturday in November at the University of Georgia is game day. And this game day was particularly special because the number 10 University of Georgia Bulldogs were hosting the number 17 War Tiger Eagles, or whatever Auburn calls themselves. They were coming to town, all right? And at the time, Georgia had an off chance of going to the national championship, but it started with beating Auburn. And so big game in and of itself, but what was really making the game special is all the rumors that were going around campus. that this game was going to be something called a blackout. A blackout is when every fan that comes to the game wears black to the game, making the whole stadium black. We'd never done it before, but people were getting pretty pumped up about it. I mean, it was in every newspaper, every radio station. There are flyers around school. You can go anywhere without somebody talking about it. But the really interesting rumor was that maybe it wasn't just the fans that were going to be wearing black. Now, Georgia football and college football in general is all about tradition. And for 70 years, the Georgia football team has worn the same colors at every home game. Red jerseys, silver breeches, and red helmets every home game, 70 years. So the idea that the players might wear black was actually kind of a big deal. Now, I was so pumped up for this game, I got to the game 2 hours before I needed to. And I, of course, was wearing black like I was supposed to, so I'm going to put on my homemade Georgia Snuggie. It's really not that hard. You just cut open the back and do like that. Oh, that feels so much better. All right, anyway, so I'm wearing black. I come and I show up, and my buddy, this is Chris. This is Chris. He's my buddy. We get to Sanford Stadium. We show up at our seats, and this guy's here. I don't know this guy. But Sanford Stadium, we're all family, so what's up, man? There you go. Go Dogs. That's how it works. All right, and of course, we're students, so we don't sit in our chairs. We stand on our chairs when we're students going to Georgia games. Yeah. This is where you start doing what I ask you to do. Remember that part? There we go. Yeah, we come and we stand on the chairs. There we go. All right, so we're students of the game. We stay on our chairs. That's how it works. We're here at the stadium 2 hours before the game starts. It's already starting to get exciting. We are here. We're in black. We look good. The people around us look good, too. It gets closer to the game, about an hour before the game. The stands are starting to fill, everyone in black. The energy, an hour before the game, is already up there, and we're starting to get pretty excited. And the team comes on the field to start warming up. And when the Georgia Bulldogs come on the field, they're wearing red. It's kind of disappointing. But I'm sitting here, I'm talking to Chris. I'm like, hey, Chris, man, they're still going back in the locker room, and when they do, they can just change. It's like a trick. They're tricking us. That's what they're doing. Right, other guy? Yeah, right. Yeah. We're all agreeing on this. Okay. So we're being a trick. They're just going to go back in. They're going to change. Okay. It's okay. So we get close to the game. The team starts going back in the locker room. We're all out there. The band's coming on the field. They're doing what marching bands do. They're playing and spelling things and all sorts of stuff. And it's about 10 minutes before the game now. The stands are almost completely full, all in black. Energy's crazy. It's awesome. 10 minutes before, fight song's going, glory, glory to old Georgia. And out comes, out of the little stand, out of the little tunnel, come the captains of the team for the coin flip. And the Georgia Bulldog captains are wearing red. And I kid you not, the stadium groaned. Ugh. When they walked out of there. This guy was all like, no. It's actually a pretty good impression. That's good. All right, yeah. No. I mean, this is it. Like, there's no chance to go back in. These are the captains. They don't have time to go back in. They're doing the coin flip and then they're playing the game. So it's pretty stinking disappointing. But at this moment, about 5 minutes before the game starts, is when the band started playing the Krypton Fanfare.
Woo!
Hey, let's go,
bro!
All right, hold up. I actually wasn't that bad. Y'all had a pretty good reaction with that one. Good job. Yeah, it was pretty good. I know, right? You good? You good? Okay, all right. It's all right. It's pretty good. All right, let's make sure we know what's going on. All right, that's the Krypton Fanfare. You're on it. You're on it, too? You got the four fingers and everything? Okay, yeah, see, you're getting ahead of yourself, all right? Hold on, okay. Plays the music, throw our hands up just like this, four fingers each hand, right? And then we holler. It's woo! I don't know why, it's just what we do. Yeah, right, okay. Okay, and then as the song is going, it's going to be like, bum, bum, bum. We throw our hands forward. Y'all just follow me on that part. By the way, there's 92,746 people in the stadium, so if you feel like joining in, everybody, go for it. Regional campuses, Effingham. I'm going to come back there. I'm going to know whether or not you're in it. Yeah, that's right. Point at him, too. Good job, Chris. All right, anyway. Okay. So, recap. Captains come out wearing red. Ah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and then no.
No.
Right, yeah. And then the band starts playing Krypton Fanfare.
Woo!
It's good. Yep. It's good. Now, over here to my left, You're right. I can't see the team. There's a big banner there. But the people above them in the stands, they're starting to freak out. I don't know why, but that's what they're doing. It starts spreading around the stadium as we start throwing our hands forward for the song. The players, they burst through the banner. Black jersey! Black jersey! Black jersey! Black jersey! That was really good, actually. That was really, I know, thank you. That's how it's supposed to work. You okay? Am I splashing you? Chris wouldn't mind. Other guy on there. That was awesome. Good job. That was great. That was a good job for you, too. Let me tell you something. For those of you who don't know about this game, y'all are good. Before you get away from this, I just want you to know that you witnessed one of the greatest games you've ever seen in your life that day. The Georgia Bulldogs went on to crush the Tigers, win the SEC championship game, win the Sugar Bowl, and finish second in the nation. Good times. Great times, even. Man, I'll tell you what. For like an entire week, I rode a high following that game. It was so awesome. But as time went by, right? As time went by, and it was a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and I started looking back on that game, you know what I realized? It's a little ridiculous. It was kind of ridiculous. See, Sanford Stadium, occupancy 92,746, your closest friends, and every single one of them lost their ever-loving minds when that team came out of that tunnel. And if you think about it, the players didn't come out of the tunnel flying. They weren't shooting lasers out of their eyes, right? They weren't Nobel Prize winners. They hadn't cured cancer. They weren't a conquering army returning from the war. 92,746 people went into a complete and absolute frenzy because 40 teenagers changed their shirts. And I was right there with them. Man, I'll tell you, the Bulldogs, they had my devotion. I would read online articles all about them. I'd study the games and how they went. I knew the first string. I knew the second string. I knew the coaching staff. I knew the recruiting class and how it compared to other schools. I would spend money on the games. I'd buy things to wear to the games. I'd spend money on home tickets and away tickets, on tailgating before and after the games, the proper times to do so. I even reacted to the wins. My whole mood would change based off of how the Dogs did. If they won, top of the world. If they lost, my birthday present 1 year in college was tickets to the SEC championship game where we lost to LSU. And on my birthday, in a subway in Atlanta, surrounded by hundreds of people trying to get home, I was weeping. I was so upset that we had lost. And you're laughing at that. People, come on. In a more serious note, I was a Christian in college, and if Georgia lost on Saturday, you would not find me in the church on Sunday because I was that bummed out about it. And they had my heart. They had my devotion. The players had my awe. The team had my sense of awe. And if you looked in my heart when I was in college, and there was like an altar there, you know what would be on it? Little Georgia Bulldog. See, idolatry is maybe a little bit more prevalent than we might think it is. And maybe for you it's something different. Maybe it's something to do with like pleasure, right? So you will drive all the way across town, passing 20 other establishments that would gladly sell you coffee, but only Starbucks will do, right? So you spend hours maybe even transiting back and forth to get what you need from Starbucks. Maybe your thing is acceptance. So that's why you're spending more money than you actually have on clothing. Maybe it's entertainment. Maybe that's why none of us seem to be able to put our phones down. That's why some of you haven't gone through the first 10 minutes of my message without checking your phone. Hashtag social media, hashtag turn down your brightness, hashtag busted, right? You think it doesn't show up, but it's making your face glow. All right, anyway. But I talk about this and we can laugh about it because we know some things about idolatry, and this is it. Sometimes all it takes is being able to see that you've got the wrong things and the wrong priority in your life. You just reprioritize and you're okay. And honestly, that's ended up what was going on with the Bulldogs. Now they don't have nearly the hold on me, which is why I can watch the Dogs fumble a snap, miss a field goal, lose to an ACC team, simultaneously losing a bet to a certain head pastor Clemson fan, and have to wear a Clemson shirt in front of all of you all night. Huh? And do you see the smile on my face? I'm okay with this. I would have been weeping like in the subway station at another time in my life. But I'm okay with this. I can laugh about it. That's because I just recognized that I had things out of sorts and I reprioritized. But sometimes idolatry gets way more serious than that. See, sometimes in a figurative sense, we spend so much time sacrificing to a certain idol that it starts to get strong and powerful and big. And when that happens, it stops being something as simple as just reprioritizing. It starts having a little bit more power in our lives, which is why the occasional sin can become a pattern, which then can become a habit, which then can become completely uncontrollable. Addiction occurs when the sin of idolatry becomes so uncontrollable, it becomes so habitual that you can't even control it anymore. That's what addiction is. And that's why you can have this idol of maybe something like pleasure. And it's just the occasional drink with some friends, but it slowly over time becomes a pattern of drunkenness that is rapidly spiraling, right? Or maybe it's acceptance, and you've become so many different things to so many different people that you don't even know who you are anymore. But the one thing you're sure of is that you hate yourself. It could be success, worshipped by having late nights at work, and you see your family falling apart, and you're not there even when you're present. And the scary thing to you is that you think about losing your wife and losing your job, and you're not sure which one is worse. That's addiction. And there's nothing in this world as defeating and hurtful and hopeless as being caught in a pattern of addiction. And I can say that because I've experienced it firsthand. When I was in the second grade, I was sexually molested by my next door neighbor. He was older than me. He was a middle schooler. And to this day, I don't know if he meant to hurt me. I don't know if he was aware of what he was doing to me. And to this day, I don't really care, because it doesn't matter what his intentions were. The wounds were there either way. I remember it pretty clearly, which is strange because I don't remember much else from second grade. But this I remember. And I remember that the experience was really confusing, because I was in the second grade. There was no context. I didn't know what sex was. I didn't know what was going on. I just knew it was wrong. I knew it was bad. I knew it was evil. But without context, I didn't really know if it was my fault or not. So I didn't tell anybody about it, because I was afraid I was going to get in trouble. This guy, it kept going for about a month. He had a brother, and apparently his brother found out about it and never happened again. But the wounds were, you know, they were already there. And as I got older and started to learn more about sex, understand heterosexuality versus homosexuality and things like that, I just started to hate myself. I hated myself. I saw myself as filthy. I saw myself as a disgusting person who had done disgusting things. I saw myself as weak, too weak to stop it. As cowardly, too cowardly to tell anybody about it. And I saw myself as broken and destroyed, especially in the area of sex. Which is why, when I was introduced to pornography by friends of mine at school, I didn't even think about resisting the temptation. Didn't even cross my mind. Because this was already the area in my life where I was broken, disgusting, filthy, and hopeless. So why bother trying to resist the temptation? Looking back on it, it's kind of in a weird way. My idol was self-hatred. And nothing caused me to hate myself and feel more guilt and shame than looking at pornography. So that's what I did. And I was addicted to it. I remember how seeing an attractive woman would cause me to obsessively think about watching pornography. And I remember how I would lie awake at night knowing that there was only one thing that was going to help me get to sleep. And I remember that after every single experience, I would sit there and just beat myself up and spend time just sitting there hating myself. And I would make promises that I would never, ever do that again. And I made a lot of promises. I kept none of them. And I was addicted for years. This is where I'm supposed to say, then I met Jesus and everything changed. I wish. But it didn't work out that way. Well, during the midst of this addiction, I did meet Jesus, and I fell in love with him because he loved me first. I believed in him. I gave my life to him. The things just didn't work out the way I thought they would. See, I thought about Jesus like he was going to be my inspiration. He was going to be my inspiration. I was going to look at Jesus, and he was going to inspire me to try harder. He was going to be my own, you know, eye of the tiger, workout montage kind of encouragement. That I, through Jesus, was going to be encouraged to fight harder and beat my addiction. That's what I thought. And for a while, it worked. And things got better. And then things got worse. See, there was something about my sin and my addiction that I did not understand. See, I thought through Jesus' inspiration that I was going to find a way to just try harder, put more effort in, and beat this thing. But what I didn't understand about my own sin and my own addiction was that there was a spiritual aspect to my battle that no amount of effort on my part was ever going to affect. And so this is where the trap is for many people caught in a cycle of addiction. We think we are going to be more physically disciplined, more mentally disciplined, and we're just going to beat this thing. But the truth is there's a spiritual aspect to our battle with this sin that no amount of effort is ever going to affect. And as long as we keep looking at Jesus as some form of inspiration, we're never gonna win. I didn't. Not for a long time. See, this is where I want to dig in a little bit. What I want to dig in on is this idea of spiritual battle. Because this is what anybody caught in addiction must know. It is not only about mental or physical discipline. Those things are important. There's a spiritual aspect. And we have to learn to bring spiritual weapons to a spiritual battle. So the Bible says that there is a spiritual war going on around us all the time. It is a war between God and Satan. Satan is a former angel, tempted to rebel against God. God cast him down, and now Satan is doing his best to win whatever he can. He doesn't stand a chance. He's a created being against an eternal God. He cannot win, so he contents himself with taking down anybody else he can get a hold of, namely us. And in the book of Luke, Luke 11 specifically, Jesus, the Son of God, encounters a soldier of Satan, a demon. And in this chapter, he fights, defeats, and frees the man who has been tormented by the spirit. And while doing so, he gives us an insight into spiritual warfare that may help you as much as it helped me. I want to read this to you. It's from Luke 11. It's also going to be up on screens. It'll be in your bulletins. This is what it says. When an impure spirit comes out of a person, is what Jesus says, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to the house I left. When it arrives, it finds the house swept and put clean, put in order. Then it goes out, it takes seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that person is worse than the first. Now hear me on this, all right? First, I'm not saying everyone that suffers from addiction is possessed by a demon. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is there's a spiritual aspect to it that we have to pay attention to. I want you to imagine something. Imagine that you live in a house out in the countryside. And this countryside is war-torn. There's a civil war going around all around you, but it hasn't really affected you yet, so you haven't really changed how you're behaving or anything. And so you still leave your door unlocked at night. When the weather's nice, your windows are open. And one day you come down your stairs, and there sitting on the couch in your house is a soldier from this war. He's tired of sleeping in a dirty, rotten blanket in the trenches, and he's decided he wants to hang out with you. And at first, it's not that bad, actually. He comes in, he eats some stuff out of your fridge, right? He watches your TV, he sleeps on your couch, but it's not that big of a deal. At first, and then it starts to get a little bit worse, and he starts to get kind of abusive, kind of threatening, maybe even terrifying. And you look at the situation and you say, I can't live this way anymore. I have to do something about it. And so you work up your courage and you work up your effort and you kick him out. And you think, man, how did he get in? Okay, through the door. Okay, so I'm going to lock the door. Did he sneak in through a window? I'm going to close the window. And you try very hard to defend your house. And while you're doing this, the soldier's going back, and he goes back to the trenches. And one night he's laying there, and he's thinking to himself, you know, that place I was in wasn't so bad. Much better than this place. But when I was there, he kicked me out. If I go back, and he may have locked doors, locked windows, I don't know what he did. But you know, if I get some of my buddies and go back, well, it doesn't matter what he did. We'll get in, and we'll live there again. You have an enemy. His name is Satan, and he hates you. And like any enemy, he is seeking your death, the death of your family, the death of your peace, the death of your faith. And he'll go right for your heart to get it. And you are not strong enough to fight him alone. You aren't. It doesn't matter how hard you try. It doesn't matter how many windows you close or doors you lock. When he brings his buddies, you're not going to win that fight. See, it's not about how many doors you lock or windows you bar. It's about whether or not you've got someone living with you that's stronger than your enemy. That's what it's about. Guys, I want to tell you something. I did my best to clean my house, all right? When I started taking my addiction seriously, started fighting against it, started putting effort into it, I was really intentional about this. I locked every door and barred every window I could find. I would think to myself, okay, did I sin after watching that movie? I will never watch that movie again. Lock that door. Did I sin after going to that site? Then I'm going to bar that window. I will never go to that site again. And I swept and I cleaned and I locked and I did my very best to protect my house. But when Satan brought his buddies, it always ended up getting worse. And some of you, you've said to yourself, you know what? I think I'm strong enough to beat this thing. And so you've tried morality. You've tried spirituality. You've tried doing better at trying harder. You've gotten more serious. You've gotten more disciplined. You've gotten more devout. I don't know. And yet it's not really working, is it? Because no manner of effort on your part will ever defeat the spiritual aspect of this battle. You can be as disciplined as you want to be, and it'll get better, and then it'll get worse until we learn to bring spiritual weapons to a spiritual battle. I remember when this clicked for me. I was at a conference. I was watching this Christian guy preach, and he was preaching about defeating sin and trying to be closer to our Father in heaven. This is what he said. He said, if what you were doing was working, it would have worked by now. If what you were doing was ever going to succeed, it would have done so by now. And when I heard that, something clicked, and I said, you know what? I'm as disciplined as I can ever imagine being. It can't be about that. I have to find a way to bring these spiritual weapons to the spiritual battle. And when that clicked for me, and when Jesus became more of an inspiration and became a warrior fighting for me, that's when my addiction changed. This is how it happened. When I realized I needed spiritual help, this is what I did. I confessed and I got help. I confessed and I got help. Now, before we dig into this, I want to lay what's at stake down, okay? If you are younger and you are struggling with addiction, you have a lot of future at stake. If you are older and struggling with addiction, you have a lot of legacy at stake. And so when I say confess and get help, I mean it. And so first one, confess. Confess. I know that for some of you in this room, there is nothing more terrifying or frightening than the idea of bringing your addiction into the light. I know what it's like to fear the rejection and the judgment and the disappointment of the people around you. And I know this lie that you may be telling yourself right now. The lie is, you know, if I confess my addiction, I'm risking my family and my job and my reputation. Get something straight. Please hear me on this. Your confession does not risk those things. Your sin has already risked those things, your family and your job and your reputation. Your confession is what may still save those things. They're already in the balance because of the addiction in your life. Your sin is what's threatening those things. Your confession may still save them. Addiction is a slimy monster. And slimy monsters, they are stronger in the dark. Light is the enemy of slimy monsters. If you want to defeat your addiction, step one, drag that thing kicking and screaming into the light and watch it shrivel up. And then get help. You are not strong enough. If you were, you would have beaten this thing already. You got to get help. And for the love of everything holy, stay away from the self-help section, please. Your enemy loves self-help. What your enemy does not want to see is the spirit of the King of the Kings and the Lord of Lords sitting on your front porch polishing his lightning bolt. That's what Satan doesn't want to see. You've got to go for help that involves spiritual help, which means if you're going to seek help, seek it for something like Celebrate Recovery. A ministry that's provided right here at the church to help people who've got hang-ups and struggles with addictions and things like that. Or if you're a man, go to the men's ministry. If you're a woman, go to the women's ministry. If you're a student, go to the student ministry. Go somewhere that will look at you and recognize there's a spiritual aspect to this. It's not just mental. It's not just physical. Spiritual. They will pray for you. Pray the power of God over your life. Pray and help guide you to be close to the one whose cross is stronger in your addiction. These are the steps you got to take. But I know, I've been there before, I know what happens. People who struggle with addiction, they've got a little voice in the back of their head, and it's the voice that never, ever lets them forgive themselves. That even in the midst of a message like this, on a day like this, it'll still be saying, not you, not you. You're too far gone. You've done too much. You've been too far. You've even tried the God thing before. It didn't work. Nothing works. It's hopeless. Jesus tells a story about a guy who had a voice in the back of his head like that. The story of the prodigal son, you may have heard it. There's a family. There's a father and two sons. Younger son says, I'm tired of all the rules, tired of all the restrictions. I want my own way. So he goes to dad. He says, Dad, I want my college fund. Dad goes, all right, fine, here you go. And the kid takes the cash, goes straight to Vegas. And the Bible doesn't tell us how long he's there living his dream. But what it does tell us is eventually he wakes up, bloodshot eyes, strung out. And the people around him just don't seem to like him as much as they did when he had a lot of money. But he still got his pride, right? And so he says, I'm going to go out, I'm going to get me a job. I'm going to get back on top. And so he goes out, but the economy's hard. Times are rough. So the only job he can find is working at a pig farm. And again, more time goes by, and he sits there. One day, apparently, he's just sitting out there, and he's looking at the pigs and looking at what they're eating. And this thought goes through his mind. He says, you know, I bet eating pig slop ain't that bad. For some reason, that's the thought that snaps him out of it. And he drops his head in his hands, and he says, I am such an idiot. I'm such an idiot. My dad's servants live better than this. And so he takes whatever he has left and he starts heading home. And all the way home, he's practicing his speech, right? He's going, all right, what am I going to say to my dad? How am I going to convince him to even let me be a servant in his business? I don't know, but I'm going to practice. I'm going to try to figure it out. But here's what the young guy's thinking. He's thinking, if nothing else, I got to be prepared for the worst. I got to be prepared that it's going to take a long time to work myself back into my father's good graces. So as he's heading home, he's getting close to the house. He's down the street, and his dad sees him. And his dad sees him. He starts running towards him, right? And as the dad's getting closer, the young guy looks at his dad, and he starts the very well-practiced speech. Father, I have sinned against thee. And his dad just wraps him in a big hug, and he says, shut up. Just shut up. Man, you're home. And he turns back, and he yells towards the house, hey, I need you to get my boy some clothes. Get him some, like a deep V to like skinny jeans. Get him some skinny jeans. Come on over here. Bring some jewelry. Call the pizza place. Get some pizzas because we are going to party. It's all there. Luke 15. It's all there. The older brother, he's been the good guy the whole time. He's been serving in his dad's business, being obedient and all that kind of stuff. And he hears all this commotion. And he heads back towards the house. As he gets close to his house, he gets all bent out of shape because he hears, and I quote from the Bible, the sound of music and dancing. Music and dancing. That younger brother is inside that house dancing. Dancing. What right does he have to dance? What could possibly compel that boy to dance? He is an idiotic, rude, wasteful addict who an hour ago was crawling back to his father's house wondering how he could beg his way back into being a servant. And now he's inside dancing? It's scandalous. What possible reason does this boy have to dance? One reason. His father loves him. And that's enough. It's enough. Some of you in this room are where I was when I was in high school, addicted and broken, and you've got a long way to go. You've got a lot of confessions to make, a lot of apologies to make. You've got a lot of help to seek, and it's going to be a long and hard and humbling road. But right now, tonight, you still have reason to dance. And that's because your father loves you, and there is no sin or addiction that is stronger than the cross of his son, Jesus Christ. Father, thank you. Thank you for what you have given me. Every scar, every wound,
every regretful decision that I made, thank you. Because I had an opportunity to be here tonight. God, I pray so hard right now for those, whether they're going through it themselves or they are just being eaten up because someone they love is going through it right now. I pray for the hearts of the people in this room who are struggling with addiction. And I ask God that in your mercy, in your grace, and by your love, that you would give them hope. Hope in nothing less than the fact that you love them and your son can be their source of freedom no matter where they are right now. And may they see that God, your son, is their only hope of true freedom. And would they respond to that tonight? I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.